Yes, so I'm Archie Bott. I've just finished my PhD at the University of Oxford, and actually will be moving to work with Matt at Princeton in the next month. I'd like to thank the conference organizers for the opportunity to speak about my PhD work, which is basically focused on a series of experiments investigating magnetic field amplification in turbulent laser plasmas, so a slightly different topic to everything we've had so far. So I should immediately acknowledge at this point that, like every laser plasma experiment, there are a huge number of people who've contributed to this project, of which I'm just one of these people. I'd particularly like to, I hope I've listed everybody here. I'd particularly like to credit Alex Shevchihin and Johnny Kogogori, my supervisors, my PhD, for the opportunity to study this particular problem. So my talk's going to have four sections, potentially five if we have time. So I'm just going to very briefly give some background motivation for why I think these laser plasma experiments are interesting. I'm then going to talk about one of the initial experiments we did, which was characterizing the evolution of dynamo-generated magnetic fields in a turbulent laser plasma with an order unity magnetic Prandtl number. I'm then going to discuss one follow-up experiment which tried to assess the dependence of the saturated magnetic field strength on the seed fields in these laser plasma experiments. And potentially I'll describe another experiment if I have time, as I said. And then I'm going to discuss some outstanding physics questions to do with these magnetic field implications, which, or these experiments, which I think are hopefully interesting. So start off with motivation. Well, the great thing is it's almost like the conference organizers planned this. Matt's given a lot of the introduction in his talk, so I don't really need to discuss that and repeat what he said. Needless to say, it's clearly interesting for the astrophysical motivations for understanding dynamo amplification in turbulent plasmas. Matt basically gave a short review of MHD dynamo theory and also beyond MHD dynamo theory into some more complicated plasma models which are necessary to understand magnetic field amplification in the intercluster medium. And he also basically described kind of the state-of-the-art numerical dynamo simulations such as, these simulations which he showed, and hopefully going forward they'll continue to be these kind of increasingly comprehensive and high-resolution simulations which can explore this phenomena. Now, what I'm going to try to argue today is that I think laser plasma experiments can offer a complementary approach to these numerical and analytical studies of the dynamo that Matt described. It goes without saying that it's obviously much, much easier to diagnose a numerical simulation than it is an experiment, and I'll talk about some of the techniques you have to use to actually measure quantities in the laser experiments. But I personally think it's kind of conceptually reassuring to verify that, or falsify that dynamo theory is in an actual plasma, or at least try to. Now, a really important question, given the motivation for this topic, is to understand to what extent is laser plasma turbulence actually comparable to the astrophysical plasma turbulence in, say, the ICM that Matt considered. And I think the answer to this is mixed. So there are some similarities. We find that we get pretty similar, if you, with the measured experimental parameters, you get pretty similar values of the fluid Reynolds number, the Mach number. It's laser plasmas are typically high beta, between 100 and maybe 10 to the 4, which is pretty similar to what the ICM is. And you also do get large, thanks to the hot temperatures of these plasmas, you do get pretty large RM of maybe between 100 and 1,000, that sort of magnitude. However, it is true that there are very much non-trivial differences between these two systems, the most important one being the microphysics. So Matt described the importance of the fact that even for these very weak seed fields in the ICM, the ions become magnetized. However, in these experiments, because the densities are much higher, the plasma is much more collisional, and so ions are basically completely unmagnetized. That being one example of a microphysical difference. Also, the different scale of these plasmas means that some field generation mechanisms that are very weak in the intercluster medium, such as the Biman battery, are actually much stronger and can be more important in laser plasmas, so that needs to be considered carefully. And finally, the difference is we obviously aren't getting magnetic Reynolds numbers of the order of 10 to the 30 in the laboratory. As I said, the jury's out as to what extent this is. I think it's fair to say that these laser plasmas are not the same as astrophysical plasmas, but I still think it's an interesting problem to consider in terms of understanding dynamo generally, what these laser experiments have to say about the possibility of dynamo amplification of fields. So now I'm going to move on to one of the initial experiments we did, which characterized the evolution of dynamo-generated fields in one of these experiments. So the basic principle is to create a turbulent region of laser plasma by colliding unstable laser-driven plasma jets. So the first experiment, which is chronologically that kind of used this platform, was reviewed here in this paper by Petros Safrakos. And the basic principle is this. So you have two plastic foils, which you irradiate with five kilojoules of laser energy on the Omega laser facility for this experiment. That creates two rear-side blow-off plasmas, which are then passed through grids. Now, you can see here that the design of these grids is asymmetric, such that where there's a hole on one side, there's a rod on the other, such that when the jets then expand and collide in the central region, shearing instabilities arise between the colliding jets, and this hopefully creates a region of certainly stochastic motion and, if we're lucky, develop turbulence. We then diagnose this region with various diagnostics. We use an X-ray framing camera to look at the evolution of the plasma turbulence over time, Thompson scattering, both the ion acoustic wave feature and the electron plasma wave feature to probe plasma properties, and proton radiography to measure magnetic fields. Now, I think the best place to start with this is to look at the X-ray images to see what experimentally you actually get. So we look at self-emitted bremsstrahlung radiation from the plasma, which is just a pure CAH plasma. And this is measured with an X-ray framing camera with a pinhole resolution of 50 microns. So for these experiments, one always has to fix the voltage bias of the electric framing camera to kind of guess roughly how much emission you're getting. And so for these experiments, we fix the framing camera voltage bias such that we can always see, we can compare all the images we have. This means that the emission we get at very early times is very close to the noise floor. So you can just about at early times before the jet collision see some hint of plasma jets coming out from the grids, but it's pretty weak. And so prior to collision, 24 nanoseconds after the laser drive is initiated, you don't really see anything. However, at about 26 nanoseconds, you begin to see some emission, and then the level of this emission rapidly increases, such that we then move far away from the noise floor and start to get some quite nice emitters images. So this is the same image, but I've just zoomed out slightly. And then, so as the experiment evolves over time, we basically, the region of emission expands, and we begin to see stochasticity emerging in the region, which is hopefully a sign that we are getting some type of developed turbulence. So as you can see, particularly by late times, we really, really do see a certain amount of stochastic structure in these images and in the emission. So to analyze this a bit more quantitatively, we'll borrow a technique that's basically from astrophysics that Arena described, and assuming the plasma is optically thin and subsonic, we relate the relative emission intensity fluctuations to relative density fluctuations in the interaction region, and then we basically use that to find the power spectrum of the turbulence. So we take an image like this, we analyze it. We use that to extract a relative map of fluctuations, and then we calculate its power spectrum, take into account the line integrated aspect of this result. And we typically find that the power spectrum is consistent with Kolmogorov scaling over about the decade that we can resolve. So we conclude from this that if we're being optimistic, that the interaction region seems to be developing manifesting some type of turbulence, and more conservatively, it's certainly manifesting stochastic motion. And as Matt pointed out, that's all you need for the dynamo to potentially operate. So now I'm just going to review what sort of plasma we have in this experiment in a kind of general sense. So we have a fully ionized CH plasma, so it's three species plasma. So the initial jets have a scale of about 400 microns in the experiment. This is the grid periodicity. And they're basically well described as being supersonic, although they're not hugely supersonic, a Mach number of about 2, and it's just collisional plasma. So we have a kind of 100 eV sort of temperatures, these sorts of densities, and 200 kilometers per second flow velocities. So upon collision, the ions and electrons are heated rapidly, and actually they're heated pretty equally just because the temperature equilibration time is shorter than the fluid timescale between the two species due to the high densities. The resulting region has a higher density than each initial jet, and you have a weak magnetic field of about 5 kilogauss and a temperature heating of about a factor of 5. Calculating some kind of theoretical quantities associated with this plasma, we basically, again, have a turbulence that initially is collisional, and so we see that the outer scale or the periodicity of this turbulence is larger than the electron-carbon and hydrogen-carbon mean free paths. Although those are also larger than the electron plasma skin depth in this plasma. And the plasma beta, as you can see, is very high, about 6 times 10 to, 20, 10 to the 4 initially. Move a turnover time later, and we observe that the magnetic fields are rapidly amplified, and we also have a higher density due to more material flowing into this region, leaving a plasma at later time which has a magnetic field that's about a factor of 25 times bigger. And actually, this field is sufficient that the electrons in the plasma become marginally magnetized at saturation, although, as I mentioned, the ions are always unmagnetized and collisional in this experiment. The final plasma beta is about 200 in the experiment, and the kind of crucial parameter is that we find that having been the magnetic energy having been much, much smaller than the kinetic energy of the experiment, becomes a small finite fraction of the total kinetic energy, around 4% in this experiment. So you can see from these numbers that I think the plasma can relatively be well described as MHD. So it's probably more MHD than the astrophysical equivalents. And the turbulence is subsonic. I'll come back to a few caveats to that statement because it's not entirely as simple as that. And as I mentioned, the crucial result here seems to be that the saturated magnetic field energy is a finite fraction of the kinetic energy. So the key result of this is effectively that we have this seemingly type of equipartition between magnetic and kinetic energy. So we have time-resolved measurements of plasma parameters, and I'll come to details of how we do that, of electron temperatures, ion temperatures, flow velocities, densities, and so on. And then we can basically, and magnetic fields, crucially, and then we can plot these over time in the experiment. For comparison, the turnover time of the plasma at the outer scale in this experiment is about 1.5 nanoseconds. So each of these times corresponds to one turnover time. Or so. And you can see that basically the initial growth rate is comparable to the turnover rate, the shearing rate at the driving scale. And then we basically see that for a few turnover times, the magnetic field stays relatively constant, although it does grow a little bit. And another interesting result is that we can measure the peak RMS magnetic energy, the peak magnetic energy. And basically find that the peak magnetic energy actually becomes comparable to the RMS turbulent energy in the plasma, which is kind of gives us some confidence that this magnetic field that we've created does in fact become dynamically significant. Again, using temperature and density measurements, we can estimate the fluid and magnetic Reynolds number in this plasma over time, and we basically find that for a few turnover times, we have a Prandtl number of order unity. It actually changes a fair amount over the course of the experiment due to the strong temperature dependence of the Prandtl number. But basically, at maximum, it's about 3 and then falls to about 1 over a few turnover times. And these results all seem to be consistent with being above the critical RM value in MHD for the dynamo to operate. So these are hopefully quite positive results, suggesting that we have indeed managed to achieve some type of dynamo regime in this experiment. Now, to just spend a bit of time discussing how we come to these results. So, as I said, we take measurements of the bulk parameters in this experiment using Thomson scattering. So this allows us to measure electron ion temperatures, flow velocities, and electron densities. And we measure them in a cylindrical region going through the central interaction region using both the ion acoustic wave and electron plasma wave features. More specifically, the ion acoustic wave feature, which is shown here, the distance between the peaks gives you the electron temperature, the position relative to the central reference frequency gives you the bulk flow velocity, and then the width of the peaks in the spectrum gives you an effective ion temperature that's a kind of a combination of the ion temperature and the turbulent motions. The electron plasma wave feature gives you the electron number density, and the thickness of this peak gives you the spread of densities. And with some reasonable hypotheses, this allows you basically to separate the components of the effective ion temperature into the turbulent and non-turbulent components, respectively. To get a time-resolved measurement, we basically repeat the experiment we did, but apply this Thomson scattering diagnostic at a different time. And then to get the transport coefficients, we just assume we have a three-species collision or plasma and apply standard theory to estimate those values. To get the magnetic field, we use proton radiography. So this diagnostic works by basically imploding a mini fusion capsule near your experiment. And what happens as a result of that is fusion protons with two species of fusion protons with well-defined energies, 15 MeV and 3 MeV, expand out from this capsule in the form of an almost uniform spherical sheet. It's a pretty low-density sheet because we haven't got fusion working yet. So the fusion protons don't affect dynamically the experiment, really, but they just their low density and their high speeds mean that basically any inhomogeneities that emerge in the detected proton flux on the other side of the experiment are associated with electromagnetic fields just sitting in the plasma. For our particular experiment, it's not electric fields are too weak to actually cause significant deviation, so magnetic fields are what we're seeing in these images. And there exist techniques when given one of these proton images for extracting the path integrated magnetic field associated with the image, provided the image doesn't self-intersect itself prior to reaching the detector. So this is an early time image before collision, and we see that basically the images are pretty blank. There's not much evidence of much structure, and the associated path integrated fields are therefore quite weak at early times. At the point of collision, we begin to see some type of structure emerging, and I'll come to how we measure what that sort of structure is at the point of collision. Move 1.5 nanoseconds later and we see a radically different picture. We suddenly see all these strong features emerging in the proton images, and then we can extract associated with this path-integrated magnetic fields that have these filamentary-type structures. And these structures persist for basically after that for the rest of the experiment. And the path-integrated magnetic field strength increases monotonically for the rest of the experiment as it progresses. Sorry? What was my plot? So on the left we have the protons, and on the right we have the path-integrated magnetic fields. To estimate what the magnetic field strength is at the point of collision, well, we can very naively just take one of the path-integrated magnetic field maps I showed just now, and take that map at the point of collision and estimate, assuming that we have a regular field structure and a known path length, and this comes up with a value of about 5 kilogauss for the initial magnetic field. We can be a bit more thorough than this and basically use a standard technique for analyzing proton radiographs, which is using a parameterized known field structure. The most plausible candidate for this is basically two cocoon-like structures, which generate azimuthal fields by the Bim and battery mechanism, aligned on acting on misaligned density gradients at the edge of the interaction region. So here we have these kind of parameterized models showing that this approach works, and we end up with a field structure that looks like this at the point of interaction between the two jets. And this more kind of thorough way of doing this attains average values that's comparable with the naive estimate. Later on, we can again borrow a technique from astrophysics and basically relate the path-integrated magnetic fields to the RMS magnetic field itself, making some simple statistical assumptions, say of isotropy, which you can test, and it actually turns out to be reasonable for this experiment. And and you can do this provided you know the path length of the fields through the plasma, which we measure using the X-ray images. And what we find is that the RMS magnetic field jumps significantly in a 1.5 nanosecond interval, which is comparable to the turnover rate, as I mentioned, just after collision, and reaches a peak of about 120 kilogauss. So this is the amplification we obtain. An important thing I'll come back to is that we only, because of the resolution of this diagnostic, we are only measuring magnetic fields at the driving scale in this experiment, which is much larger than the resistive scale. And so there's a question, if anything, you should regard this magnetic field estimate as potentially a lower bound. If there are fields on smaller scales, we just won't see them with this diagnostic. To measure the maximum magnetic field, we find bounds in the maximum magnetic field using two techniques. So we can basically use the fact that it must be the case that the ratio between the RMS, the mean path-integrated field, and the maximum path-integrated field is a smaller value than the equivalent quantity for the magnetic field itself. And that, using that ratio, we can calculate, we can give a lower bound. And for the upper bound, we basically assume that one of these structures has only been crossed once, and that gives effectively shows what the peak possible value could be for the magnetic field. And we find that these typically gives peak fields of between 400 and 900 kilogauss. And this, as I mentioned, this magnetic energy is comparable to that of the turbulent motions. So I think this work is promising. To me, it throws up two initial questions, and these ones I often have been asked in response to these results. The first one is that the magnetic to kinetic energy ratio still is quite small. Can you really claim that the field is dynamically significant given it's only 4%? And I think the answer to that question is yes, and I'll come to an experiment which I think demonstrates this and some other pointers. The second is that people say, have you really reached the true dynamo regime? In that an unfortunate kind of fact of these later experiments is you do create a relatively large a non-infinitesimal seed field by the Bim battery mechanism, the 5 kilogauss value that I mentioned earlier. And could this kind of 24 times amplification of the field strength simply be the result of stochastic tangling or transient growth? These simulations done by Alex show that if you're in the pre-dynamo regime here, you still do get some amplification of magnetic fields and magnetic energy, and just before the dynamo threshold, it's about a factor of 100 in the magnetic energy. So to address those questions, as I said, the proton radiography diagnostic only resolves the driving scale fields. So if you had any small-scale magnetic fields present, as you would in the dynamo, the true energy ratio would be much higher. So in some sense, it's quite an interesting result that what we do see is that even though we aren't only resolving the driving fields, we still get a significant amount of energy at the driving scale, which shows that however fields are being generated in this plasma, we do end up with fields at large scales, which may explain certain astrophysical observations. Another thing I'd like to point out is that the energy ratio just beyond the dynamo threshold, so suppose we're here, typically is found not to be super large anyway in the sort of for these sort of magnetic and fluid Reynolds numbers that we have. Interestingly, if you take an equivalent MHD simulation with a similar magnetic Reynolds number and a fluid Reynolds number, look at the spectrum you get seemingly at saturation and calculate the reduction factor due to this resolution thing, you actually find an energy ratio that's slightly smaller than what we measure in the experiment, which shows that this objection that this energy ratio is quite small may not necessarily hold. The second question is that, as you said, to answer the second question is that if you look at the stochastic tangling, typically before you reach the dynamo regime, it seems that at most it's a factor of 100 amplification of the energy, and we do get more than that. So whilst we are a bit close to the boundary, more close to the boundary than I would to be entirely confident about this, I think both of these objections don't necessarily hold. However, I do think we, having had this feedback, we decided we want to try to do a few more experiments to see if we can pin answer these questions a bit more thoroughly with some actual data, and I'm going to describe one of those experiments now. So what we did is we did a very similar experiment to what we did before, but now embedded our platform inside a pulsed magnetic field generator known as MIFEDS. And basically, in the absence of laser plasma, this generator creates a 10 Tesla magnetic field that has this configuration across the target shown here. Now, this 10 Tesla field actually is not strong enough to be particularly dynamically significant. The magnetic energy is only about 10% of the jet kinetic energy. But the idea is that if we introduce this field here, as the plasma jets expand out from the foils when they're radiated with the lasers, and then we have a resulting interaction, that this having this strong magnetic, well, stronger magnetic field than the BIM battery field around means that we have to end up with a stronger trapped seed field inside the plasma. We then apply exactly the same diagnostics I discussed before to measure these quantities and to basically see whether this seed field changes the magnetic field structures we get. We basically do a MIFED on-off comparison with this target to assess the effect. So I'm going to start off by looking at the MIFED off case. So this is an X-ray image. It's now done from a slightly different angle. So you have one grid here, another here, and you're looking at a kind of angle of about 20 or 30 degrees here. So for this experiment, we actually changed the voltage bias so you could actually see the jets prior to collision, and you can see that we have kind of fingers of plasma extending out from the grids, which are, even prior to collision, are already becoming turbulent. After collision, we begin to see a region forming, which, as before, expands and becomes more turbulent at later times. Now making the comparison with MIFEDS off and MIFEDS on, so MIFEDS on is on the left, MIFEDS off on the right, we see that in terms of the initial jets, they're actually a bit more extended and collimated with MIFEDS on, which is not entirely surprising given a potential the Lorentz forces acting on the plasma jets. And then at later times in the images, we see that the transverse extent of the region with the MIFEDS on actually is greater. And I'll come to it as an explanation of why that is the case. However, if we look at the fluctuations themselves, qualitatively, they seem broadly similar, just by eye. We can be a bit more quantitative about this, so we can measure the size of the interaction region for both the MIFEDS on and MIFEDS off cases. And we find that at earlier times, the MIFEDS on is slightly larger, although at later times with an error, it's hard to distinguish between the two. Similarly, the RMS density fluctuations are largest at the early time, but then become similar at later times within the error. And a reasonable explanation for this is that there's a moderate increase in the typical jet velocities due to the collimating effects of the magnetic field. There's additional evidence of this, which I'll come to. If we again do the same thing that we did before and look at magnetic energy spectra, aside at earlier times when there is a slight difference in the spectra, at later times, we basically, within the error of the measurement, have the same spectra. So our conclusion is that the spectral properties of the turbulence are only mildly affected by the MIFEDS. In some sense, introducing this magnetic field doesn't change the dynamics of the experiment significantly. Again, we have Thompson scattering. The only difference with the previous setup is we now have a time-resolved setup, thank you. We measure basically in a particular shot over a particular time the evolution of these parameters in a particular volume. And we basically have very broadly physical results to what we had before. Temperatures about 450 eV after collision and electron densities of just over 10 to the 20 per centimeter cubed. And we do indeed actually find a moderate collision timing difference. So that this is the parameters over time at about 25, 26 nanoseconds. And then we see that at 25 nanoseconds, we observe the heating and the formation of the interaction region with the MIFEDS on, but we don't with the MIFEDS off, which is all consistent with a 5% increase in the jet velocity. Now moving to the magnetic field evolution, we have, again, proton radiography. So these are the proton images we had with the MIFEDS off. So at the point of collision, we see we have weak flux features in the photon images with associated small path integrated magnetic fields. At later times, we again see pretty similar stochastic structures emerging, and then we can do exactly the same analysis, extract the path integrated field and estimate the spectra, and we obtain pretty similar RMS fields as we did in the previous experiment. Now doing the comparison between no MIFEDs and MIFEDs, MIFEDs off and MIFEDs on, there's a bit of a complication in that the large-scale field distorts what the raw proton image looks like, and so analyzing these is a bit of a pain. But you can basically do exactly the same analysis, and you find that at the point of collision, there's actually an enhanced region of fluence with the MIFEDs on and stronger path-integrated fields, which is consistent with there being a larger seed field in this interaction. If you then do the same comparison post-collision, there is some difference qualitatively between the proton images, but then when you analyze the path-integrated fields, you find that the stochastic magnetic field is statistically very similar. Again, within the error of the spectral measurements obtained from these fields, we can't see a difference. So we basically conclude that we have reached some type of ceiling. We've introduced this larger seed field, but we can't amplify the seeds. We don't seem to be able to amplify the stochastic field that emerges any further, which is consistent with reaching some type of ceiling and maybe and saturation. So there are a few outstanding physics questions, which I think we still need to think about. So of course, one of the main objections you might have to this is this experiment is very much non-stationary and inhomogeneous. So between just before collision and after, you have a rapid increase in density and temperature, and it's not entirely clear compared to the periodic box simulations of the dynamo what effects this will have on the evolution. Another interesting question, which I think is particularly relevant for this workshop, is the question of microphysics. I said before that I thought this experiment could be well described as MHD. It's not quite true in the sense that the naively calculated resistive and viscous scales actually fall on smaller scales than the electron and hydrogen mean free paths. It's a kind of quirk of three species plasma transport, which might suggest that on very small scales that you might have some collisionless effects, maybe small scale viable, and so this will affect the evolution of any magnetic fields in this case. Another reasonable question is that at the point of saturation, the electrons become magnetized, and it's well known that that changes the form of any Ohm's law, and thus it might well affect the saturation mechanism of this experiment, and this is something we need to think about a bit more going forward. So I think I'll come to my conclusions. I sadly didn't have time to talk about the third talk, which was an experimental... I've got a minute. So this was another experiment where we basically, very similar, done in the LMJ facility, and we basically tried to alter the parameters such that it was cooler and see, can we turn the dynamo off? And in short, these are the parameters, thank you. And we found, we used proton radiography to measure the magnetic field structure. And sorry to rush through this. So these were the proton images we got. So prior to collision, we just see very little, although you do get some viable type structure. And then we get stochastic structures as usual. And to cut to the chase, you can do the same analysis, and you find that in this experiment, the magnetic energy is a tiny, tiny fraction of the kinetic energy at saturation, which suggests that in this experiment, we haven't obtained any sort of dynamo. And that is in spite of the fact that the kinetic energy for these two experiments is actually pretty similar. So I think I'll conclude there. The point to make is that we've done some recent experiments on the omega, which seem to demonstrate the existence of a plasma dynamo in these experiments. The magnetic energy increases about 600 times from the small seed and attains about 4% of the kinetic energy, and the maximum magnetic energy is comparable. We've done the investigations of what happens if you reduce the larger seed, and we find consistent results that suggest that the field is dynamically significant to saturation. And I think there are various interesting questions about the importance of physical processes, say microinstabilities or magnetization, for these as how to interpret this dynamo going forward. Thank you very much.
Plot of what happens without the grids?
No. So we've never done that experiment. The difficulty is it's not the same. So the grids actually change the temperature of the interaction of the jets prior to collision, because basically as the rear side blow-off plasmas expand out from the foils, you get a first shock that kind of bounces off the grids, and so you get a slower plasma that's hotter that emerges. So it's not quite you can't really do a comparison of no grids with grids in a direct sense. We haven't done that experiment. It would be very interesting to do it, to see what
Because without the grids, it would be a collisionless shock experiment.
Yes, except we wouldn't get a collisionless shock. You'd get a collisional one just because the jet velocities on this experiment, as you saw, about 200 kilometers a second. And the collisional, the mean free path of those has a very strong dependence on velocity. I think it's v^4. So you will just get a collisional interaction.
Would be interesting to see that.
It would be interesting. The other thing which is quite interesting is you do, I talk about a jet velocity. Of course, it's not really just one jet velocity. The plasma that arrives very early on actually is faster. And we do, as I showed in, you can kind of maybe see here in this LMJ experiment, at very early times, there does seem to be some type of almost Weibull-like at very early times, which may be pre-plasma interacting. But the point is, once the density gets high enough, it all is collisionally damped out, unlike the Weibull, the XL experiment, where you have much higher flow velocities.
You have a lot to look forward to, Archie. Thank you. Very nice talk. And as you know, these experiments have tremendous challenges of diagnostics.
Yeah.
So one has to rely on simulations. Questions?
Yeah.
Did anybody try to simulate this using a PIC code?
Not using a PIC code. So there are people, the Flash team at Chicago, do large and basically MHD fluid simulation. So it's rad MHD hydro with three temperatures. And those experiments, even the fluid simulations, getting all the laser interactions, everything right, are very, very expensive. And so those simulations are relatively successful. There are a few disagreements between, say, in some of the magnetic morphology. It would be quite interesting with these sorts of parameters, I think, maybe not to try and simulate the whole thing with the foils and the grids, but just to do almost a periodic box simulation, maybe try and do a PIC code with similar parameters and see what happens.
Right. So in my group, as you probably know, Jack Matteucci did not do your initial conditions, but did in fact do an end-to-end simulations of two colliding bubbles, different setup and all that. The reason I mention it is because he investigated carefully the role of Biermann.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that if you do PIC and do Biermann, there's a factor of about 2 to 4, purely coming from the fact that you have anisotropic pressure tensors in PIC that give you somewhat different Biermann fields.
Interesting, okay.
Furthermore, so that would not appear to be huge, because, you know, factor of 2 is an order of unity, but in the context of your experiments, you're looking at B amplification.
You've got to add all the factors up, exactly.
You're right, so you've got to be careful about numbers.
Yeah.
The second part of it, and that's more subtle, is that he actually elucidated the role of Biermann in mediating the reconnection processes.
Interesting.
And what he found, in fact, is that there is a suppression effect that comes about. But getting back to your work, this whole factor that you see of the amplification would depend critically on some of the collisionless reconnection physics that you did say was a limitation of the study and would be worth looking at. And it would be nice to look at your initial setup and figure out how much of this you can rather peel away to anisotropic pressure and collisionless effects and then quantify how much of it is really the dynamo.
So one thing that saves us a little bit from Biermann becoming too strong is that the thermal conductivity is very high, and we've actually got experimental measurements of the temperature, kind of path integrated temperature, again borrowing a technique from astrophysics, and we see that for these omega experiments the temperature is very uniform indeed, and so Biermann is kind of suppressed somewhat. When you see these density structures, you don't have associated temperature structures, everything else is just pretty uniform, so that I think reduces potentially the value of the Biermann seed field that you might get. It's interesting to ask these questions about whether, as I said, on small scales, Biermann might act differently, just because, as I said, there's not a huge... The mean free path and the scales are all a bit close to each other. So it's not... I think maybe doing a PIT simulation would be quite interesting.
Hi, Archie. Thanks for that. So two questions. One is a bit more open-ended than the other. First, with the magnetic energy spectra that you see... So I remember what it looked like when you had the MIFED, is that what it was called?
Yeah.
MIFED field on, and it was some sort of -5/3 spectrum. I forgot what it looked like without the seed field turned on, if it was similar, but because you're looking at large-scale fields, like you said, only the largest scale, why aren't I seeing something like a Kazantsev spectrum or where it increases instead of something that just goes down?
So the point, actually, there is a reason you can't remember what the spectrum looked like, because I didn't show the spectrum.
Okay, good.
So it basically...
I'm not going nuts.
So it turns out there's experimental difficulties with basically the diagnostic has a really poor effective resolution. You can't well determine what the spectral slope is over any reasonable scale. And I've got some extra slides on this. You can show, for example, that if you apply post-process, do this technique to flash simulations, you basically see because of the particular parameters, blah, 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 that's too many slides. I'll get there eventually, it's right at the end. Basically, you get this huge, yes, here. So these were some flash simulations under the experiments, and so this is the exact path integrated field you got, and we analyzed the region here. This is the proton image, and then we kind of naively analyzed this image, assuming we had everything right. Mm-hmm. So the true spectrum in the box in the center of this in the flash simulation is just shown in the red, and you see that the extracted spectrum, the tail is completely unreliable. So I didn't show the spectrum because I don't believe those measurements, okay. And that's due to the parameters of the measuring, the diagnostic.
And then the other one, which is a bit more open-ended, is you said that you can only see the larger scale fields through the proton radiography.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'm surprised that you can't infer the presence of smaller scale tangled magnetic fields because, I mean, there's been a lot of work on sort of charged particle diffusion through tangled fields and things like this. Can you not infer something about the strength of the small scale field or the scale of the small scale field from some diffusive properties of the...
Potentially. So we have done a little bit of that. And actually, for example, looking at, so you might expect a kind of almost diffusive blowing due to the small scale fields. Trouble is it's slightly hard to work out exactly, because you end up with that quantity. It's basically BRMS squared times some correlation length. And if you have a range of lengths, it's not entirely clear what's contributing to that. I think in future, you could potentially redesign these experiments to try to get out more information about the small scale fields. And that's definitely a good next step to take.
So first of all, I want to say I'm a fan of this type of work, but there are several issues that have puzzled me for years. So one of the things is the scale separation. Right? Mm-hmm. So your bubble is about a millimeter at most, mm-hmm. right? So, and then your smaller scale dynamics mm-hmm. about a micron. So it's at most 1,000, maybe a factor of 100. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to claim turbulence over a relatively small scale separation. Mm-hmm. So it's more like a fluctuation dynamo type of.
No.
So I was very curious, although it's expensive propositions, whether you've tried, for example, doping the target so that you radiative cools it so that the temperature isn't as high as, I know you want to get a high temperature so you get a high Prandtl number.
Yeah.
But if you just slightly lower the temperature mm-hmm. and then use the still have the kinetic energy, mm-hmm. so then can you tell whether there's still a factor of say 100 amplification B fields? That's kind of working in the direction of showing that the small scale things, at least in your setup, didn't really play a role.
Yeah.
So then, but kind of towards the direction of killing the whole notion that this is actually testing turbulent dynamo issue, right? So did you guys ever try that kind of situation?
So the LMJO experiment, that was with aluminium rather than plastic. And obviously aluminium is more radiative than the plastic. And so actually the reason the temperature in that experiment is cooler, about 100 EV after collision as opposed to 400 or 500 EV is precisely this effect. Well, the trouble is what you see is that even that factor of 4 in temperature seemed to then switch the dynamo off entirely. The dynamo stopped working.
Oh, okay.
We don't see rapid amplification of fields anymore, even with that factor 4 of temperature.
Okay. The other thing is that the MyFast field direction is along the jet direction or perpendicular to the jet direction?
So it's mostly along. So in principle, naively, you'd expect the plasma just to flow onto the field lines. It's not quite right, so you do get some field being pushed. So when you do flash simulations of this, for example, some field flows in and some kind of ends up being squashed.
That probably explains why there's not much effect.
Yeah.
Okay, so very nice talk, Archie.
Thanks
for that. So the thing that, naively, wouldn't you expect that if you magnetize the electrons, you would suppress Biermann completely? I mean, it's kind of related to what Amitabh was asking.
Mm-hmm.
would you suppress the Biermann? So do you, is there a way you can disentangle this from the experiments with and without the MIFEDs? Whether the Biermann is actually suppressed?
So what you're saying, you think in the MIFEDs case on, the Biermann might be suppressed. So the, even with the MIFEDs on, because the initial jet temperature is cooler, the electrons aren't magnetized even with MIFEDs on initially. It's only, you're right that with the MIFEDs on case, once the collision happens, then in the interaction region, the electrons are, I think, are magnetized. I need to double check that. So my understanding is, I think Alex has a paper where he derives, certainly in strongly magnetized plasma, what you'd expect the Mildred Ohm's law to come look like. And you still do have a Biermann term, but it has the parallel pressure, I think, instead of the just the isotropic.
I would assume it would affect the misalignment of the grad N and the grad T, yeah. Right? So that would be where it would. The thing that I'm thinking of is because, for example, if you imagine how most of us think of the Biermann battery is seeding fields in protogalaxies.
Yeah.
You just assume that you have these shocks then which produce these misaligned temperature and density yep. gradients going along the shock surface.
Yeah.
And if you had Vival competing with that, it could easily magnetize the electrons and then suppress that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good idea. I'd have to think about it a bit, but yeah, maybe let's discuss after and work out how that would work. The other thing that's not entirely clear is that there are, as I mentioned, as that calculation, Alex's calculation shows, that there are, for example, there's you can get the facts you have potentially in a strongly magnetized plasma anisotropic, the perpendicular and parallel pressures aren't the same, means that there can be, I think, other flux freezing breaking mechanisms, and there's like one term that generates other terms. So I'm not sure what effect that would have.
Very interesting talk. If you look at the ICM, radio halos and radio relics show that the magnetic field is very intermittent and shows these long filaments. It's very characteristic. And with this new Jansky field A observations, you see this even better now. So I was wondering, have you actually followed up on your filamentary structure, quantified the degree of intermittency, and compared this to the ICM fields?
So one difficulty you have with doing that, so we have to a certain extent done that. So for example, you can look at the intermittency of the path integrated field that we see, and actually, interestingly, if you take one of these maps for the data, you get a non-Gaussian, it's non-Gaussian. So if you look at the statistics, it's non-Gaussian. And if the path integrated field is non-Gaussian, then the field itself has to be non-Gaussian. So yes, these fields are intermittent. Whether to be anything more quantitative than that, I think would probably require working with simulations and then trying to extract the degree to which, if you have an intermittent situation, what would the path integrated field look like, and then work out, well, what degree of intermittency will have. We haven't done that yet, but you could, I think, do that quite reasonably. And but these fields are intermittent.
Yes. So in the k to the minus 4 power law you showed in your last spectrum, is it consistent with so one of the last spectrum, it has k to the minus 4 power law, right?
Yeah. For the LMJ, yes.
Yeah, so is it consistent with any dynamo theory, or is it due to plasma instability or what?
So that's a really good question. So another thing I didn't have time to mention with that experiment, because of the lower temperature, the turbulence is actually, the Mach number of turbulence is about 1.5. So it's unlike the previous experiment, which is subsonic. That's actually supersonic, or not hugely supersonic, but supersonic turbulence. So I was trying to work this out. I think if you have a low RM supersonic plasma, you might expect a K to the minus 4 spectrum. A bit like you get a Glitzin spectrum if it's subsonic, you might expect a slightly steeper spectrum, but that's very speculative. And it's not clear to me, because our RM in our experiment is about 4C, so you shouldn't be in that regime. So I don't really understand that spectrum, to be honest with you. That just comes entirely from the data analysis.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So is it possible to do proton radiography with lower energy protons that would have a smaller gyro radius that would allow you to probe the weaker fields, the small scale fields?
Yes, you can. So there are two ways, as I mentioned, that you can do proton radiography with a fusion capsule or using a high intensity laser source. And the high intensity laser source gives you a thermal spectrum of protons. The problem is, so you probably can get slightly lower with the TNSA sources. The problem is that if you go too low, things like collision or broadening start messing up your images. So you're about 2 MeV is really the lowest that this technique, I think, is used. You might be able, some people want to try and use other types of particles, maybe alpha particles or.
You also get 3 MeV from fusion.
you do get 3 MeV. So you can use, and for the early time collision, for example, the 3 MeV image is quite useful because you can actually use that to get a more precise measurement. So yes, for the weaker fields, using 3 MeV is a good idea, and that gives you an increased sensitivity range.
Great. Any more questions? Okay, let's thank both speakers. And we'll be back here at 11 o'clock for the second half of the morning.